creating, marketing, and finding folks who wanted to go short. You said initially you wanted to do this because you were told by senior management to find, oh, are we back on?
Yes.
Great. To find greater liquidity, fine. But then your CEO group presumably had lots of demand for the long side, if you could find enough shorts. So how did that work?
Well, it depends on when or what you
please
mean.
Take, please yeah, take us through sure. the time period.
Well, from the perspective of the CDO group, one of the sort of risks, if you will, of doing it in one of these CDOs is that ultimately you're not able to complete it because you can't. You may not complete it because either you couldn't sell the CDO tranches, or the bigger fear to people was that because everyone was so bullish throughout 2006, that you couldn't acquire the collateral at the proper spread. So, for example, if you assumed that you could sell the AAA CDO tranche at one spread and the BBB at another spread, and you knew that the equity in the CDO had to yield a certain in order to get that sold. So you would need to acquire the collateral at some spread that enabled the math to work, right? So one of the fears that people had, and rightfully so at the time, was that you would start to do a CDO and you'd maybe acquire half the collateral, for example, and then the spreads would have come in so much that you needed, for the math to work, you needed, say, 250, just as an example. And when you started, it was at 275. And you were able to do half of it at 275, and then all of a sudden it was trading at 200. Well, now that doesn't work, because if you have half at 275 and half at 200, that's 237, right? And you need 250. So one fear that people had was that you would spend all this time getting ready and negotiating and whatnot and analyzing securities and acquiring securities, and then you wouldn't be able to complete because you wouldn't be able to get the spread. So many times CDO managers would make one of the conditions for doing a CDO with you that at day one your firm provided a certain amount of collateral, the hope being that if we had just, for example, 25% provided the first day, that the possibility of completing the 100% before the spread went too tight would be, it would go up. So there were times in 2006 and the end of 2005 where the CDO group would come and say, we are trying to garner a mandate from this CDO manager, and one of the conditions that they have put upon us is that we provide a certain amount of collateral as a show of faith and our belief that it will get done. Since our CDO group isn't market makers in these underlying home equity securities, that wasn't really something that they could provide. The bank didn't give them the authority to go short subprime or what have you, or make markets in securities. They're a new issue function. So they would come to my desk and say, "We're hoping to get this mandate. If you would provide, in my example, 200 million, we think we can get the mandate instead of one of our competitors." So we provided that. So it came from them as opposed to us saying, "Hey, go do CDO," because we didn't need to do that. Deutsche Bank was not one of the top underwriters of CDOs. It was very easy for my desk to short to buy protection on subprime mezzanine from the other underwriters who were doing more CDOs than Deutsche Bank anyway. So that's how it was. That would be the interaction. Would be they would ask us to help them respond to some of the conditions, or this one specific condition.
The long ramp-up period, I certainly understand in the cash market, because there are a limited number of subprime deals that were coming, and they, you know, takes time to accumulate the loans for a mortgage and bring the RMBS to market. But in the synthetic market, you theoretically could write $300 million overnight if you wanted to. So could you be even more specific about the timing and the I understood what you said, but what I don't understand is if you're dealing with a synthetic CDO, why there is such a timing issue.
Sure. Well,
in the ramp up.
You know, I would say that in 06, a lot of the deals were part synthetic, part cash, so it's a little bit that. But there's also an issue with many of the CDO managers had specific collateral that they liked, that they thought was, you know, better. So there was a strong view that some people had, you know, that early 2006 was better than late 2006, or that one originator was better than another originator. So there was some concern that even though, to your point, the synthetic market could be created overnight, that there wouldn't necessarily be anyone willing to buy protection on specific securities that a manager wanted. And then the market still, throughout 2006, were very bulled up. So there would be a concern that that when it was announced that XYZ manager was doing a CDO with an investment bank, that spreads might, between the time when the details were negotiated and when actually the details were finalized. So when the investment bank met with the CDO manager, spreads were 250. They had a first meeting, and they said, oh, that's interesting, thanks for your proposal. Tomorrow we're going to meet with one of your investment bank competitors. Maybe that next day, spreads already were 10 basis points tighter. And then there was a certain amount of back and forth. So the markets were moving around. And
so in this dialogue and the CDO group's request to you, would they give you a list of securities that their prospective client manager would say, we want this stuff? Or would you give them, you know, 100, 200 million of collateral that you had chosen?
It would be an iterative process, because usually the manager would suggest either A, they would say, these are 100 securities we like, how many of them are you willing to buy protection on? Or perhaps B, they would say, these are the types of securities we like. We want ones that have this much California or this much loan-to-value ratio or whatever. Which ones fit our criteria that you're willing? It would be an iterative process. But my recollection would be that the managed CDOs that we did, the majority of it came first from them saying, these are the ones we want. How do these fit? Eventually, in 2007, to your point, where the market became much more liquid, there was no need for really any of this, for anything but seasoned securities, and the CDO manager would just announce to the world, hey, today I want these 20. What price will you put on these 20? And so if we were underwriting the CDO, we would put prices, and many of the other dealers were, and if someone else was doing it, we would. So in 2007, it was very simple for us to buy protection from whoever we wanted. Then it was very simple for the managers to get protection, because it became a robust market where it wasn't so much in the early part of 2000. Really, throughout 2006, the market sort of tightened, not inexorably, but I think that it ended 2006 more or less where it had began. I mean, I don't remember exactly. I know that I didn't make any money big short 2006. That I remember.
And the sales force that you interacted with, was that the same group as the sales force that the CDO group interacted with?
I'm not. Can you clarify? I'm not exactly sure what the question is.
Well, I saw an organization chart that shows that you
there. This is
were
one
separate.
Of the things I gave Amy for copies.
And so in your work in responding to investors who either wanted to be
Page
long
five.
Or short, there was sales coverage involved.
Right.
So the and for the CDOs, they were, since you were really the supplier of any shorts, they were only looking to long investors. So the sales coverage for the CDO investors, were those salesmen and saleswomen, if there were any, the same people who also were salespeople that you interacted with in your business.
Sure. Deutsche Bank has one sales force. So for example, there were people that bought CDOs, and to hedge their investments in CDOs, they bought protection on specific credits of the CDO or what have you. Or so it's the same salespeople. What's true is that I spoke to a broader array of Deutsche Bank sales force about business than the CDO group, but I probably spoke to almost all of the same salespeople they spoke to, plus other ones.
I just want to say, just since we might not remember, and this is being taped, that the document is DBFCIC 00008455 through 6-1. Just so we have a record of that.
And when the CDO group did sign up a mandate beyond this original chunk of collateral to seed the CDO, were you and your desk involved with providing the bulk of the rest of the collateral for the CDO group?
Well, the manager would then go out to the marketplace and say, these are the securities that we're interested in today, and the whole market would, or whatever market participants were interested, would put prices on. Some bonds we would say, you know, we're already short too many of that one, we don't want to put any price on that one, or whatnot, but they would compare our prices to other firms, and then to the extent that someone else had a better price, we would intermediate for them. So perhaps Lehman Brothers would buy protection on XYZ security from us, and we would buy protection into the CDO vehicle. The way the vehicles were created is the only counterparty to the vehicle was the underwriting bank. So whereas it will show up that 100% of them were provided by our desk, the reality is very different from that. So what will happen is whoever had the best price that day, from our perspective, they provided it, right? So from if you just looked at between the CDO and investment banks, you would see that all of the trades the CDO did were with Deutsche Bank. And if you looked at a CDO underwritten by Morgan Stanley, you would see all of the shorts into that CDO were provided by Morgan Stanley. But behind that is that instead of writing swap documents for each investment bank into each CDO, which would have been a paper, you know, would have been a lot of work, the way that the market dealt with it, which had nothing to do with the decision or anything, was that whoever underwrote the CDO, they were the sole counterparty to that CDO. So we may have done none of the CDS, meaning 100% of it could have come from all the other investment banks, you know, each did 20% or whatever, five banks did 20%, but there would be those trades between those investment banks and us, and then then trades between us and the CDO vehicle. So I think it's important to note that if you were looking just who bought protection from the CDO, it would always be entirely the underwriter of that CDO.
Was it really easier to do it that way?
That's what I was told. I had nothing to do with the new issue guys. Like, it wasn't really something that I focused on. I mean, I didn't like it because then I had to write all these tickets, right? Because now I have exposure to all the other investment banks, right? So let's even pretend that it was just that I did half and the other half were other people. So if Deutsche Bank has $5 billion of CDOs, $2.5 billion are with me, and then I have $2.5 billion of exposure to other investment banks where I'm intermediating between them and our CDO. When it was done, I was told this is how you have to do it because it's a lot easier to do it this way and everybody's doing it this way. But as it turned out, of course, when Lehman Brothers went under, all of a sudden you had this situation where you thought you weren't short. In our example, you thought that Lehman Brothers was short and you were just intermediating. And obviously the converse is true as well. If I was short into a Lehman Brothers CDO, I thought I was short and I wasn't short because my counterparty disappeared. So I think there were, you know, that's how it went. I don't know if that answered the question or not.
It did. Roughly how much of your business related in some way or another to the CDO business?
A small percentage. I didn't calculate it, but I would well
and,
under
and I meant the new issue.
Right. Well, you mean meaning in terms of let's just say, for example, we were short $100. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing the question is, if I'm short $100, how many of those dollars were into our CDOs versus other CDOs or other market participants? Is that the question or not?
I wasn't referring necessarily to your own short. I meant more in your trading flow business. Was a significant part of your business somehow interactive with the CDO originations at Deutsche Bank?
No. I think that we did 60 to 100 billion of CDS trades, and Deutsche Bank's CDO was not 10. I don't know how many CDOs we did, but less than that. So, I mean, I'm estimating these numbers, so, you know, if it's important, someone will give you the facts.
Okay.
But I'm highly confident that it's not a quarter of our business was
okay.
That.
Okay, great. Moving on a little.
I just wanted to ask. I think that it talks a little bit in the book about you pitching some hedge fund investors and them saying, how can you be trying to convince me to go short these positions that your firm is actively marketing as good investments? Do you remember any of those conversations?
No, not specifically.
Generally, do you remember that sentiment, or do you remember?
I mean, it seems plausible somebody would have asked that. And
I'm not asking you to speculate,
right.
So that's fine. That's fine. I mean, did you ever think about it being, for lack of a better way to describe it, an ironic sort of position to be in?
Well, many people at Deutsche Bank thought that I was, you know, wrong, or they thought less of me than that, shall we say. So it, that's, you know, I think that's part of being in a large organization where ultimately people aren't all told to think the same thing. Everyone has a view. If you look at Merrill Lynch, David Rosenberg was their chief economist. He doesn't work there anymore, but he was for many, many years saying the stock market's about to crash, it's about to crash. And Merrill Lynch was issuing IPOs of stocks all the time, right? So Deutsche Bank is a firm of thousands of people, and they don't all have the same opinion.
There is, I have not seen any market-wide data of, on volumes of single-name pay-as-you-go swaps versus indices versus aggregate amounts of single names that ended up in synthetic or hybrid CDOs. Do you, just from your experience, have a sense of those market volumes and what was much larger than the other?
No, I mean, the ABX was a market that we were almost entirely like a pure market maker in. So it wasn't one that I spent a lot of intellectual capital on. We basically bought and sold all the time in that. I mean, so, and I think that the ABX had a lot more sort of fast money, if you will, where people were making trades that they were intending to get out of in days or hours or weeks, whereas obviously the CDO investments were much longer term, and many of the people that bought single name CDS protection were having a more longer term view of it. And it's one of the reasons they did single names as opposed to the ABX, or the reason people did the ABX was because they wanted the liquidity to get in and out. So I think looking at ABX volumes the volumes might have been astronomical, but if I buy and sell six times in one day, does that count as six trades or does that count as one? So it's difficult for me to answer that question.
There's a slide about the ABX in the June, I think it's June 2007 slide deck. I just wondered if what...
Sorry, Dixie, what page?
11, I apologize. Page 11. If you could comment on at this point what you thought the impact of ABX being on the market.
Sure. I think the ABX...
No.
Right. So this is just what Deutsche Bank traded, right? This was what we traded. So it's not... It's hard to know how big we were as a percent. You know, were we a quarter of the market? Were we 5% of the market? That would be my guess of the range. but we weren't more than a quarter, and we weren't less than 5%. So, in reading this, the ABX, you know, looks like 35, you know, 52 billion in the first quarter versus 37 billion in the first quarter. If I do the math very quickly, and in the fourth quarter, it would look like 30 versus 21. So the ABX was bigger. And I don't know if I answered the question.
What was this supposed to be telling people?
I guess it was supposed to be telling people that you could trade this market because there was a lot of flow. I think one of the questions that people had for me, particularly in the beginning, was, well, how do I know that I can get out if I want to get out? Do I have to come back to Deutsche Bank? Can I trade with somebody else? And so I think the point of this was, well, there's a lot of, this is just how much trading we're doing. So there must be a lot of other trading going on away from us. So there will be liquidity and there will be your ability to get in and out. I think that was what our point was.
When do you think that liquidity sort of arrived, so to speak? If it wasn't really there in the early part of 06, when would that have been less of a concern because of the change in the market? Bless you.
You know, the second half of 06.
And could you compare these numbers or volumes just in the roughest neighborhood sort of way to CDS on CDOs?
CDS on CDOs is somewhere between 1/4 and 1% of this. Not, you know, it's at most 1/4 of this, when that's a guess. And I bet it's less than 1/4 of it, if I had to. But I don't think it's more.
And between cash and ABS CDS, how did that, just trying to get an overall picture of your business since you had different components to it.
Sure. Well, the cash market, to the extent that cash bonds were sold into CDOs, they really would never retrade because CDOs were by and large buy and hold. So the cash market was a lot smaller than this. I mean, another way to look at it is how much cash is created per year, and then to estimate how many times it actually traded. And I would bet that the average cash bond didn't trade once a year. So if there were, in triple Bs, I think maybe $10 billion was issued a year at the height, roughly. So we would have maybe in the whole year, you know, the whole market in the whole year maybe would have traded $5 billion or $10
billion. So you weren't actively trading subprime AAAs as an important part of your business? No, I meant the whole enchilada.
Yeah, I mean, that was the big business before. I would say we traded the AAA business of all ABS, because back then nobody really would have thought to focus just on this or what have you, was about, at Deutsche Bank, a $75 to $100 billion a year business. So that would include credit cards, auto loans, and things like that in terms of the secondary trading.
But that was all under you.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
But I couldn't tell you what the home equity AAA part was.
Fair enough. But that was sort of the largest part of your business for most of this time period, no?
By volume, it was the largest part of the business. But until sort of the crisis came along, the margins in these products, in the AAAs, were almost zero. So it was a lot of volume, but not a lot of actual, you know, profits or risk or focus. I mean, the AAA home equity securities, which now are 20 cents, 30 cents, whatever, 50 cents on the dollar, used to trade, you know, 5 basis points over LIBOR, 4.5 basis points over LIBOR market, you know, $5 billion up. Like there was, you know, very, very liquid, very, very transparent, virtually no margin in them. So that was a lot of our volume, but it was never particularly, you know, a lucrative. It was really a client service thing.
No. In your view, how did the introduction of ABX change the market?
The ABX enabled there to be transparency in a way that never was before. So, for example, the ABX was something that could be put on CNBC. You couldn't put the pricing of the Long Beach 061 M9 tranche on CNBC because there was no transparency, there wasn't enough trades. So I think that the ABX alerted people to that there was a problem with these securities earlier than people would have understood had it not been for that.
I'm going to move into more big picture stuff unless you...
Get some more.
Thank you.
Get some more. Yeah, I have some more. Sort of.
Want to keep going?
Yeah.
So I did have one more specific. As you were out recruiting shorts explaining how being short fit into a portfolio. I'm not sure there is any legal obligation or any moral obligation, but did you tell people that you also were short?
Absolutely.
Did you consider that there was either a moral or legal obligation, or was that part of your sales pitch?
I think it was our obligation to provide people with accurate information for them to make their own decisions.
Was that necessary to disclose in order to provide them with accurate information?
I told people I was short because they would say, why are you here? I never had somebody come in and say that they should short a market. So I would tell people that I was short, and I thought it made sense for them to be short as well. So it was part of my pitch. But I think it's your obligation to give investors the whole, to give them accurate information and give them as much information as they ask for, and then allow them to make their own decisions.
So Michael Lewis sort of calls you patient zero, that from you, you can trace all of these different short positions back to you and to this presentation. And I'm sort of curious to hear who were some of the buyers of this protection that you pitched?
Well, I don't think I was patient zero. So you asked before, are there any inaccuracies in it? I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think that...
Although the idea did not come from Michael Worry.
Right. Well, I think that I... was involved in having lots of people consider shorting it. They made their own decisions. I think I suggested the idea to more people than probably anyone else. So from that perspective, I think that it's fair to say that a lot of people who got short because they met me or somebody they know met me. But certainly there were people who got short because they met somebody at another investment bank, or because they came to their own independent conclusion, like Dr. Burry did. He came to his own independent. He didn't become short because he met me. And John Paulson didn't become short because he met me. So, you know, if you're asking, I would guess that Deutsche Bank sold protection to more than 50 and less than 100 investors. So we could probably provide that. You know, I don't have it all memorized by any means. If you said who were some of your biggest counterparties, if that's the question, that's an easier one for me to answer than all of the people that
was one of the questions I had.
Obviously Paulson, Phil Falcone's Harbinger Capital, we did a lot with. As a hedge fund in Boston called Baupost that did a lot with us and did a lot with everyone else. Elliott, which is a hedge fund in New York, we did a lot with. QVT is another New York-based hedge fund that we did a lot with. And those are some of the ones that popped to mind, and obviously the ones in the book we did trades with as well. And you don't need me to tell you those.
Were these sort of people who were convinced early on, or did some of these need more convincing?
I would say that, again, it's memory, so I'm speculating to a certain extent because I don't remember completely. Polson was one of the first ones to be involved, for sure. I think that Elliott and Baupost also became involved rather early. Harbinger, on the other hand, didn't become involved until December of 06. So they were one of the, you know, they sort of, but they got involved in a very aggressive way when they got involved. Who was the other one that I mentioned?
QBT?
I think that they were reasonably early, but I don't remember for sure.
How many pitches did you do on a monthly basis?
I mean, I think it changed over time.
Okay.
So it wasn't like the same every, I didn't have like a quota each month, I'm going to do this many, you know, but I think that I probably pitched somewhere, you know, plus minus 250 funds in total over a 2-year period. So simple arithmetic would be, I guess that's 24 months, so that would be 10 a month, but it probably was concentrated in the second half of 06 through the first quarter of 07, so maybe those were more like, you know, 20 a month, and the other times it was less, I guess. I'm not sure.
So as I understand it, if you go out, you're selling protection. You have a short position, but you're actually taking a long position when you're going out and selling this to investors and hedge funds. So the 50 to 100 people who actually ended up buying their protection from Deutsche Bank. Who did you then go to provide the offsetting long position?
Most of our CDS purchases were from UBS, Merrill, and Citibank, because they were the most aggressive underwriters of CDOs.
Who at
so you did go into CDOs, it just didn't go into your CDOs.
That's right.
So would you mind, who at, if you recall, who were your the counterparties that you dealt with principally at UBS and Merrill and Citi?
No, well, we wouldn't deal with them from a trade perspective. We would deal with them from a settle perspective. So if TCW was doing a CDO with UBS, for example, they would announce to the world, we're doing a CDO with, and they wouldn't even, we're doing a CDO with UBS. They might not even, actually the way it would work usually is that we're doing a CDO. We'll tell you later who it's with. You don't need to know that right now. Here are the 10 credits today that we'd like to sell protection on. We're soliciting levels. So we would go to TCW and say, okay, we're 250 on this one, we're 260 on this one, or what have you. And they would come back and say, okay, number 3, and number 8, and number 9, and number 10, you had the best price. You didn't have the best price for the other ones. Your counterparty is UBS. And then the next day, or maybe the same day, TCW would again say, okay, here's another 10 credits, or maybe it was even the very same 10 credits. And they'd say, well, this time you were number 1, number 3, and number 8. Your counterparty now is Citibank. So we weren't calling Citibank or UBS. We were interacting with the CDO manager, who was then telling us, call Citibank, and then I wouldn't call Citibank. The back office person at Deutsche Bank would call the back office person at Citibank and say, hey, we just did this trade with you. And then Citibank, like I was explaining before, would do the trade with the CDO vehicle.
And would your ultimate counterparty be Citibank, or would it be the CDO?
Citibank.
It would be Citibank.
That's
I think you said this. I just want to make sure I absorbed it. So, but the call coming in to you would be from the CDO manager.
That's correct.
And I apologize for this not soaking in. To me, how is it that Citibank is your counterparty and not the CDO? If the CDS is going into the CDO.
Because the way the CDO market, which again I had zero involvement with, the CDO market was established as whoever was the underwriter of the CDO, they would be the sole counterparty to the CDO vehicle, and they would intermediate with the street. So Citibank, every CDO they did, they were the only person that bought protection from the CDO.
Okay,
if they weren't short at all, they sold protection to all, let's pretend that they did no shorting at all. They did all the shorts into the CDO, and they got 100, and let's pretend that it's only Deutsche Bank and Citibank, they're the only two banks in the world for this example. 100% of the shorts would be, there'd be, and it's a $100 million CDO, there'd be $100 million of CDS between Deutsche Bank and Citibank, and there'd be $100 million of CDS between Citibank and the CDO.
Okay, so the ultimate, maybe this is the wrong way to think of it, but the ultimate counterparty would be the CDO, but you didn't care about that because your counterparty is Citibank.
That's right. The documents.
So they may have a back-to-back with the CDO, and you don't know, and you don't care. Your counterparty is Citibank.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you. And those were principally your counterparties, or you know that those were exclusively your three counterparties?
They weren't exclusively our counterparties by any stretch. I would say that the majority of our CDS went into CDOs done by those three because, and this is speculation, I didn't actually review this before, because they were the three biggest underwriters by far. So they were the people that we would buy protect. Most of our business was into CDOs, be they Deutsche Bank or other CDOs. There was some amount of business, like we alluded to before, that there was a mutual fund at Fidelity that picked them. There were various hedge funds that tried to do long short. So like, for example, in equities, you might say, well, I love McDonald's stock, and I think it's going to do a lot better than Coca-Cola, than Burger King. So instead of just buying McDonald's stock, I buy McDonald's and I short Burger King, right? And hopefully McDonald's does better, and I don't really care if they both go up or if they both go down, as long as McDonald's does better. So similarly, there were hedge funds that said, I could pick the one, you know, I think that the May deal from Countrywide is much better than the June deal from Countrywide. So I'm going to try to get long the May and get short the June or what have you. So that was a certain amount of our business. But the majority of our business was into CDOs, be they DB or otherwise.
Okay. And then the ultimate holder of the long position in the CDOs, you wouldn't have any information on that?
No. Citibank is doing I think we now know that a fair amount of it was Citibank themselves. But we wouldn't know that.
So, based on the short positions that you took, you said that you started making money, high it was February 07, and then you took it back down. You started. What actual realized gains has Deutsche Bank made on these trades? I mean, on the short positions that you took.
Right. I mean, it's important to recall that
if my Are they not all done yet?
Well, actual realized gains, okay.
Right, that's what I'm talking about, actual realized gains.
Right, I mean, Deutsche Bank as an institution lost billions of dollars on this stuff because the other groups of Deutsche Bank had the opposite view of me and much bigger size than me. I couldn't even begin to answer your question. I can try to guess because I think about things only in mark-to-market. So I don't really, it doesn't really matter to from when I think of my profitability for the bank, whether if a security is broadly accepted to be worth 10 cents, for example, I think I made 90 cents, and it doesn't matter that actually the reason it's trading at 10 cents is because 90%, you know, because a huge percentage of the loans are in what's called REO, is real estate owned, and they're about to be sold, you know, and the loss is going to be recognized, or because they've actually taken a write down, because from our perspective, the bond is trading at 10 cents, and that's that. But to answer the question differently, if you looked at the ABX, I think it would give you a broad overview of the market. Most of the ABX BBB tranches have a current factor of around 20, which means that 80% of the corpus has been eroded by losses. I mean, I'm not sure. I think that's about what the corpus is. And usually what that means is that four, you know, a couple of the bonds have some of their money left and the rest have none left. So,
are you speaking of triple B's here?
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's where our materially all of our short is in triple B's. Later on, we may have shorted a little bit of something higher up, but not really anything material. I don't even know how to, you know, to guess. I mean, I think again before, like if I bought protection from you at 200, and then I sold protection to Walter at 550, is that count on your definition as realized profit or not? Because then maybe the bond still hasn't taken a write down. But since we did those trades back in June of 07, I've been getting 550 from him every month and I've been paying you 200.
Right. I'm not actually talking about sort of the fee generation or the money you make by standing in the middle there. I'm actually talking about what someone like the hedge funds who went short, like Paulson, like people who got paid out, actually the realized gain. And it just sounds like that's not the way you look at it. Is that because, I mean, is that at least partially because that's how you're compensated? So that's how you, I'm just trying to...
Well, it's not related to how I'm compensated, because I'm compensated ultimately at sort of the decision of Deutsche Bank, which has a lot to do with it. But it is how we book the gains and losses of our business, which is
marked to market.
Right. So, and then again, even similar to that is, so if John Paulson, let's just say that if he just shorted the ABX in our example, would mean that in the bond there's 20, and the bonds have 20% of their corpus remaining, and they're trading at 2 cents. So now, if he had done no trades at all, there would be two ways to look at his profits. You would say that, let's just say he did $100. He made $80 because there's 20 cents left. That would be one way of saying what it is. You could also say he made $99.9 because he made $80 on what's paid off. And the last $20, the last $20 that's left is trading at 2 cents. Right? So he made $96 if you looked at it from that perspective. The third way to look at it would be, well, John Paulson actually covered all of his shorts already, and he's not short anymore. So he made it's over, right? Like, he didn't make the 96 cents. Maybe he made 70 cents because that's when he got out.
He got out at a different place.
When Citibank decided it might be time to hedge, that's when John got out. So he made 70 cents in that example. So depending on whether he traded or not, and depending on whether how you define, that last 20% of the, so broadly speaking, and there are many that zero is left, and there are some that 100 cents are left. But if you use the ABX as an example, I think, and, you can look it up on market.com website, so if I'm wrong about how much is left, I don't want to, I'm not saying how, I'm not going to lie, but, like, it's a fact.
These are
how
ballparks.
It's a fact how much is left. I'm guessing that number is 20, but maybe it's 5, whatever. Whatever is left is left. So you can, the realized losses of the industry, whoever actually was the holder of those CDS contracts at the time in the past and currently, is unknowable whether John is still in, using him as a euphemism for the shorters. But what you can know for certain is how much CDS contracts have been paid off by looking at what is left in the ABX, as a broad proxy for the industry.
Okay. Thanks. Do you have a follow-up on that? So there's a specific story that I wanted to ask about in the book. Lewis tells a story about you negotiating collateral calls with Howie Hubler at Morgan Stanley. Do you remember that?
I do.
I think that Deutsche Bank came and said the marks were 70, and Morgan Stanley said no, the marks are 95. Could you just describe that exchange, and if you wouldn't mind, try to, in the context of describing what happened there, sort of help me understand how the collateral provisions were working in the contracts, or whether these were actual payouts on the contracts?
Sure. The margin rules or law, the margin contracts is not an area that I'm particularly versed in, so I'm going to speak about what I think is.
But you were involved in the back and forth.
Right. Well, there's two different things. I was involved in the back and forth, and then the other is exactly how the margin works, and that I know less about. So from what I understand, the way trades are settled between investment banks is ultimately each side sort of puts in their value, and this is across, tens of thousands of trades that are done between Deutsche Bank and Morgan Stanley, between Deutsche Bank and Merrill Lynch or what have you. And ultimately, as long as it's within some sort of tolerance, nobody really worries about it. This is how I understand it to be. It's not an area that I would have been part of. So if the total that we thought they owed us $50 million, and this, again, isn't just my trades. This is all the trades that Deutsche Bank did and currencies and equities and everything, thousands and thousands of trades. And Morgan Stanley said, no, you guys owe us $50 million. Nobody would really worry about it. They would just say, okay, you know what? No one goes bankrupt, that's an investment bank, so it doesn't matter. But when it got beyond some sort of threshold, then people care. So from what I recall, I was sort of called up and it said, we have a huge dispute with Morgan Stanley, and we've tracked it down to you. Because, everything else, okay, they say something's worth 99, and we say it's worth 98.5, and a lot of this is just they close the books at 3 o'clock and we close the books at 5 o'clock or again, there's tens of thousands of trades between Deutsche Bank and Morgan Stanley and Deutsche Bank and every other broker across the whole investment bank. And all of this is netted somewhere that I'm not part of, right? But I get this phone call. We have a huge difference with them. And it seems to be because of these things. Like everything else is kind of close, you know, but this is not close.
And you can't, this being
these four trades that were actually done to hedge our new issue of CDO business. They weren't trades for my book. They were trades that were done, you know, at my sort of behest, but they were done because our new issue guys had a variety of CDOs on their books that they did with him. But since the CDO group is a new issue group, they don't mark securities. Like the secondary group marks securities, right? So we're marking the securities, even though the trades are not actually my trades. They're the new issue guys' trades.
But so, they're the short side of whatever Morgan Stanley had the long side.
That's right. But CDO. I'm saying, but the trades ultimately are not really flowing into my group. They're flowing mainly into the new issue group. So I get this phone call. Your marks differ so much from Morgan Stanley's that, you know, that this is where, you know, we've never had all the years and years, you know, things are never more than maybe 100 million apart. And this time they're a billion apart, and it's because of these super seniors. And you can't be right, because they're super seniors. How could they possibly be worth 70? They're still rated AAA.
So these were short positions on super seniors of ABS.
CDOs, that's right.
Synthetic CDOs.
That's right. Maybe they were synthetic.
Maybe that doesn't matter.
But they were, the only way to short something would be to do it synthetically. But, I mean, you can short, it's difficult to borrow something, particularly if there's only one in the whole world. It's one thing to short a stock, you could always borrow it. But if there's only one in the world and I short it to you, for all I know you own it, how am I ever going to be able to deliver things? So they were all synthetic, right? So they were either synthetic CDOs or they were synthetics on actual CDOs, whatever it was. So we get this phone call, hey, you know, your marks are $1 billion apart from Morgan Stanley's marks. You can't be right. They must be right. So, well, actually, you know, we think that, you know, look, we don't really, we have a process for which we value these, and you know, we didn't know what that they thought they were, not like we thought they thought they were 70, just like us. Like, we didn't actively try to do anything. We just marked them where we thought it made sense. So
who's involved in actually marking them and deciding that the number is?
You know, someone who works for me marks the securities based on either, depending on the security, based on either actual, you know, trades we see in the market of the same or similar security, or in the case of some synthetic CDOs, you had a model where you put in a correlation, maybe we'll talk a little bit about that, and a recovery assumption, and the model says, okay, this bond is worth X or this bond is worth Y, right? So we said these are worth 70 cents. So this quickly got $1 billion difference, got attention. People said, well, first of all, again, how could you be right? Because it's super senior, and, you know, how are they worth 70 cents? And second of all, it's $1 billion. So what are we going to do? So we quickly were brought up to speed on the procedure, which we didn't know before. And the procedure is, or again, as I understand it or remember it, that between investment banks, it's a little bit different than between a bank and a customer, where maybe the bank has a little bit more rights to say, well, this is what it's worth, and that's sort of that. I mean, and again, I'm not even sure how that works, because it's not something that is part of my role. But the way that it works with investment banks, I know that a little bit better because of this Howard Hubler thing. To the extent that we couldn't reach an agreement, there'd be an arbitration between us and them where three other dealers would be chosen to arbitrate the dispute. So we say you owe us $1 billion, they say no. There'd have to be a hearing scheduled at some point in the future, and then depending on who the judges were, maybe they would agree with us, maybe they would agree with them. So we felt that there was, you know, significant risk that this would be a huge amount of time spent. It would take a long time. We'd be exposed to the $1 billion between now and whenever the hearing was held. It wasn't going to be held tomorrow. You know, because you have to.
Because if you're going to take that position, then you have to market on your books in that way.
Well, we were marking. There's two different things. One is we're marking our books wherever we see the market. So in this simple example, we've reported $1 billion. If it was as simple as this, which it's not, we reported $1.2 billion profit. Right? We did $4 billion with them. We're marking it at 70. Right? So we said, hey, we made $1.2 billion. They at the very same time are saying, well, it's worth 90. If that's what it said, you know. So they think, hey, we lost $400 million in this example, right? So we're reporting $1.2 billion of profits. They're reporting $400 million of losses. They're not the same thing. That's separate and distinct from this collateral call, right? That's a completely separate issue, right? The issue is, well, we think that they owe us $1 billion that they're not, $1.2 billion, whatever, that they're not, I guess par versus 70 would have been $1.2 billion, that they're not paying us, right? So they can mark their book wherever they want. We can mark our book wherever they see the market. I mean, they can't mark it wherever they want. They have to mark to market. But they can mark their book wherever they see the market. We mark our book wherever we see the market. I don't see a problem with that. The problem arises when we say, well, you owe us a lot of money and you're not paying us. That's different from sort of, you know, reporting gains and losses in terms of on your earnings statements, the quarterly earnings or what have you. So,
and presumably, if you had waited for the arbitration route, then you would have gotten zero in the meantime.
Right. We would have gotten zero in the meantime. So in the meantime, we would have this issue that Deutsche Bank would say, wow, these guys owe us $1 billion. We're waiting. And we don't like being owed $1 billion by somebody. So the decision at the time was, well, let's try to find a way to come to an agreement with them so we don't have to wait for arbitration. And, you know, and I don't know who told him that exchange. I mean, I think that there's probably a lot of people at Morgan Stanley not happy with Howie because of, you know, things. So there's a lot of things in the book that are about what happened at Morgan Stanley. And somebody must have told them, look, this is how it went down. And that's kind of how it went down. I mean, I think that's broadly how I remember it. I remember that they said, we're doing lots of trades in the 90s, so we're right and you're wrong. And I remember saying, then do some with us at 77. And if you could sell them to somebody else at 90, you know, feel free. Like, that's not my concern, right? Like, my concern is I think that these are worth somewhere in the 70s.
So, a couple of questions. First, do you recall if this was a margin issue or if it was a collateral issue? I mean, is there a difference there? Because I'm just trying to remember, because we talked a little bit earlier about the provisions, and I don't want to go somewhere where you don't know. But if you remember, since you were involved in the specific negotiation, if you will, if that was, because it was clearly based on a difference in the mark-to-market value of the underlying assets.
Yeah, I mean, there were no realized losses yet, if that's what you mean.
Where did the $1.2 billion come from? Was that some percentage of?
Well, that would be 30 points on $4 billion. Right, so they hadn't given us anything yet.
But so you expected them to give you everything, the difference between...
No, I didn't...
Is there something in the contract?
I don't know what's in the contract. I don't know. That's not something that I would have focused on. I don't know if they're supposed to give us... I don't know.
Who can we talk to at Deutsche Bank who might be able to help us understand how that worked?
I don't know. I guess we could figure that out. I don't even know.
I would,
what the contractual provision might be that would cause Morgan Stanley to have to meet a collateral call as a result of it.
If we could just set up some sort of hour-long with someone who would have had on the phone is fine. I would appreciate that, just
sure.
So I can...
Then we'd be happy to get back to you.
I also am sort of curious on your thoughts on if the contracts provide for this dispute resolution mechanism, if you will, of going to the three dealers and having an arbitration at some date in the future, and that poses a substantial risk to Deutsche Bank in the meantime, given the big difference in the marks between Deutsche Bank and Morgan Stanley. Does that indicate that there's some sort of problem with the system, with the way that the transactions work, if it exposes banks to that sort of risk?
I'm not really sure. I mean, maybe I don't understand the question. Sorry.
So the risk would be if Morgan Stanley isn't around at the time the arbitration takes place, not able to meet its obligations.
Among others. I mean, I'm just wondering, based on that experience and maybe others if you had them, whether you see flaws in the system, in the way these contracts are set up, or at least in the way that they are, in the way that disputes are resolved. You know, if you're thinking about potential problems and actual problems that happened during the course of the financial crisis related to how people interpreted the contracts, how people interpreted the way that you got to different marks and resolved disputes relating to them. I mean, if you don't want to, that's fine, but if you have views and or could comment on the way that those were set up and any problems that they pose that might need to be avoided in the future. I mean, I would be curious to hear your thoughts.
I don't really have any views about it. It's not something.
Did you think that the system worked well, the way that it ended up working in that instance?
You're talking about the dispute
between Morgan Stanley
mechanism that was in the contract, right?
Yes.
I think it worked okay because we came to an agreement that was some sort of compromise. I think that everybody tried to be reasonable about it. I think that they had a view about the value of these securities that was wildly different than ours. I mean, I don't think it was different when the trades were done, but it was different, you know, when things were changing very, very fast at that time, and their view was very different than ours, but we ultimately were able to come to some sort of compromise with them, and we had to compromise with them repeatedly because the market continued to deteriorate and go against their views. So whereas the first argument was we thought it was 70 and they thought it was 90, the second argument might have been we thought it was 60 and they thought it was 80, and the third was we thought it was 50 and they thought it was 70, or, you know, there was more. I don't remember how many there were, but there was more than two and less than 10 conversations about this, and it worked out each time. Because each time we came to some sort of middle ground that, you know, that both sides were somewhat comfortable with.
And when you would argue that, would you argue competing trades, ABX, some assumption that went into your model? How would you?
All of those. I know. Each side would argue, would cite things that made the most sense for them. So if we cited, well, the ABX says X, they'd say, well, the ABX isn't broad representation because it's only 20 credits instead of 100 credits, or this deal had a manager, so he picked the ABX as sort of a random assortment, and he picked the best 100. That would be sort of their argument, and our argument would be, well, it's broadly similar to the ABX, and the ABX indicates X or Y. I mean, I don't remember exactly what the arguments were, but each side argued for their side.
I guess I'd be most interested in if you recall arguments about home prices or about delinquency rates.
There weren't any arguments about home prices for sure. There wouldn't really have been arguments about delinquency rates, so there may have been arguments about how, you know, what ultimate default rates were going to be. So it's not so much delinquency rates. I think the biggest issue was more related to modeling assumptions about correlation, which is, you know, what's the plausibility of how many of these tranches can default, right? Like, so if you thought correlation was low, you would say, well, only a few of them are going to default and the rest of them are going to be okay. And if you thought the correlation was high, you would say, well, they're kind of all going to default or none of them are going to default.
What sort of model did you use to do your mark-to-market valuations? Do you know?
Somebody who works for me who knows a lot more about math than me would have built the model, and I don't know. And it wasn't, you know, Eugene, and I don't know whether they used I don't even know what these words mean, but there was talk either they used a Gaussian copula function or some other math that's way over my head.
Okay.
So I don't really know.
When you talked about correlation, did you actually talk about numbers, or did you just talk about the concept of that the market being largely correlated or not?
Or the makeup of the individual CDOs at issue?
More the latter. I mean, when we were disputing with Morgan Stanley, there may have been times where we said, okay, we think, let's try to figure out the problem, right? You say it's worth so much more than us. How can we figure it out? So there may have been, and we didn't do this every time because you kind of realize you were talking to somebody who wasn't talking the same language you were talking. But so we went and said, okay, credit number one, we think it's worth 80, and they'd say, we think it's worth 82. Credit number two, we think it's worth 70, and they think it's 71. So like we went through all of them, we're like, well, that's not the problem, right? Because the difference, it wasn't at the home equity mezzanine tranche level that there was a big difference between what they thought and what we thought, at least as memory serves. The difference was, so we said, great, and what does your model say that's, so we broadly agree on the price of the securities within reason. So that's not the problem. Okay, well, my model says it's worth 90. Well, my model says it's worth 70. So trying to ferret out, you know, something is different about our two models if the inputs, at least the one input that was easy to compare was the price of the underlying securities. So the inputs were kind of the same. So how come the output is different? So one of the big, the three, again, I don't, you know, I have a liberal arts background, so I, you know, I'm like a common sense thinker. I'm not a big math thinker. I was like certain that I've turned off my devices, so every time I hear something, I'm like, So the like the math related to how these work kind of, is, you know, maybe this is one of the reasons that I was able to do what I did, because I didn't understand the math as well as some other people. I just sort of understood like the common sense part.
That's what I'm telling people at the commission all the time.
So the way that I understand how these models work, you know, is that a key determinants of the value of these securities is the price of the securities, the recovery rate, the price is supposed to indicate the possibility of it defaulting, the recovery rate you assume if they default, and then the correlation, so meaning the likelihood that if one defaults, the other ones were default. So our differences with Morgan Stanley weren't so much in the price of the securities, because we were able, as market makers, to have reasonably similar views about what each of these securities was trading at. So the difference had to either be in, well, if it defaulted, what it would recover, or if one of them defaulted, how plausible was it that the other ones would default? And we didn't, I don't remember how, it was obviously, these were contentious phone calls between the parties, so I don't remember, and it's also roughly three years ago now that we had them, so it's a while back. But I think that the biggest difference between them and us was correlation as opposed to recovery, but it could have been either.
Just to clarify one thing, this is not a final resolution of the contractual obligations between the parties. This is
not
just
at
like
all.
A collateral call, which could change a month later.
Absolutely, and it, well, it did change, generally kept going down. But we, again, as before, I don't know how, what I needed to do with them was agree on a price. So we couldn't have any more, okay, 90, 70. We had to come to an agreement, 85 or 80 or whatever, right? And then how that fact was flowed through in terms of money's exchange wasn't something that I had, like, you know, what was important for me in terms of what management wanted to hear from me was that you can agree with Morgan Stanley on a fair price for this, right? So if that meant that they were out $600 million, I was sort of finished, right? And then between Deutsche Bank and Morgan Stanley, they would decide, someone else would decide, well, you're out in theory, on paper, you're out $600 million. So whether that meant that they owed us $60 million or $599 million, I have no idea. It wasn't something that was part of my job.
Okay, thanks.
But the issue is the collectability of a receivable. If it's small enough that you're not as worried about it, that Morgan Stanley would be able to pay for it in the future. It's when it's $1 billion.
Sure. My understanding was that for, you know, somewhere in the millions was not an issue. Whether that was $10 million or $210 million, I have no idea. But because it's just not practical to constantly be arguing about it or sending it back and forth, because there was no way, again, I gave an example before, maybe we closed the books at 3 o'clock and they closed the books at 5 o'clock. And that's, you know, could be a big difference. And it would wash away, you know, if we all set our watch at the same time, that difference would disappear. So there is some margin below which, and again, this is across the tens of thousands of trades that we had with Morgan Stanley and with anyone else, that the bank doesn't worry about it. And I don't know what that is.
But a large part of the issue is the counterparty risk when it gets past a certain level.
I don't understand what you're...
Was the primary concern that Morgan Stanley owes Deutsche Bank a whole lot of money, so we need to get the money? Or was it Morgan Stanley may end up owing us a lot of money, a big number, and we're afraid that they might not pay us ultimately, and this trade's going against them, so we better get some of it now?
I don't think it was either of those. I think it's Deutsche Bank needs to mark their books to market accurately every day, and they're afraid that I'm mismarking the book if it's so different than Morgan Stanley. I think that at the time of these were happening, Morgan Stanley's CDS was trading not in any distressed way at all. So I don't think that the concern that Deutsche Bank had about it related to them as a counterparty. I think their concern was as much with me as with Morgan Stanley, as with, like, you know, you and again, though, just to be clear, again, these were trades not in my book. They were trades in someone else's book anyway. But broadly speaking, they're like, how do we know that you're making as much money as you say you are? Because apparently Morgan Stanley doesn't think you're making any money.
So, and you may have said this, so I apologize, but at the end, if you start marking it at 70, they start marking it at 95. If at the end you agree, instead of Morgan Stanley paying $1.2 billion, they pay $600 million, do you end up marking your book based on the $600 million swap, or do you end up marking it and whatever the correlating mark would be, or did you end up still marking it at 70?
I think that we probably ended up marking it at the 600.
Adjusted it back, okay.
Okay, this it was also, because if we didn't, the difference would still be showing up, and management would be getting reports of, you know, we have this huge difference. So I think that we would mark, if I remember correctly, you know, we marked it at what we agreed to with them.
Okay. You said earlier, apropos of this is ultimately what happened with Lehman, and then I think you said something about people thinking that they were short, but they weren't.
Right.
Could you explain that a little bit more? I still don't fully understand that. I think that the book talks about it a little bit too.
Yeah, I don't know that it was in the book, but maybe it was. I don't remember. What I meant when I said that was, we had trades on with Lehman Brothers that when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, those trades disappeared. So if you sold protection to Goldman Sachs and you bought protection on Lehman Brothers, you think you're flat. So when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, all of these trades disappeared.
All of a sudden, but you're still long Goldman.
That's right.
Goldman.
That's right. So nobody really thought of, when they created these, when the process was created, that when you do a CDO, the counterparty is the one investment bank.
Instead of the structure.
Instead of it being, you know, every single trade goes into the CDO by itself. Nobody really thought that any of the banks. I wasn't part of that, but that's how I would understand it to be now. And what I do understand is that when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, all of the derivative trades that people had with Lehman Brothers ceased to exist at that moment. So one's exposure to various markets was different than one thought, or different than it was the day before.
Buy insurance from an insurance company that goes out of business.
Right. I mean, if you had a life insurance policy and they went out of business and then you passed away the next day, there would be no one to pay your relatives or whatever, right? It's kind of the same thing.
Although insurance companies have specific capital requirements that investment banks don't have. The protection that you sold to the hedge funds and the other investors, do you know what the purpose was for those investors entering the transactions? For example, did you know if they were, for example, making a speculative bet, or if they were trying to hedge positions that they, or exposures they had?
You wouldn't know, and no one would tell you, but as sort of an educated market participant, and some people might have told you. Some people had them because they were, my example before, they liked the May deal and they hated the June deal. Or there were people who thought that the difference in price between the double B and the triple B, for example, was too wide. So maybe they bought double Bs and they shorted triple Bs. Or maybe some of the people that we were involved with, I knew that they were a high yield hedge fund or an emerging market hedge fund. So I viewed it as they were long Brazil, short subprime, or what have you. And there were obviously some like Paulson where it seemed like there was nothing on the other side. They were just short. But nobody would really feel obligated, nor would I really ask, well, what else are you doing? They would say, that's not your concern. Like, make me markets in this, and I'll do whatever else I'm doing. You know, I'm doing it, and don't worry about it.
So I went through a lot of the presentation with Eugene this morning.
And are we shifting gears right now?
Yeah, you want to take a break?
Bathroom?
Yeah, I'd actually like to take a break, too. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but I wanted to ask a few questions. So.